Well, good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
I know there's some mothers here. Happy Mother's Day to all of you. Today I'm going to talk about past stories of the Buddha's earlier lives. They're called Jataka tales, J-A-T-A-K-A. In Asia, at least, they were the main way of presenting the Buddha's teaching. And so if you were an ordinary layperson, or perhaps a monk who was illiterate, etc., that you learn the real lessons of things like the Four Noble Truths, the Eightfold Path, the Middle Way, proper ethics, etc., through the Jataka stories. So they used parables to teach the Buddhist way. And so rather than reading one of those tough sutras, etc., you'd hear really great stories. And they're stories that range from something for little kids to older, mature adults like myself, basically to teach the way. Because many people couldn't read, you'd have storytellers that would go from village to village and tell these stories. And also, if you went into some of the temples, both in Japan, throughout Asia, you were likely to see pictures of some of the Jataka stories on the altars, etc., just to remind people, basically, of these stories. These stories are for people of all ages, and if you go into Google and you Google Jataka, or if you can't remember that word, just past lives of the Buddha, you'll see that there are numerous books, and they usually say something like for children of all ages, which I assume includes somebody like me. There are also numerous paintings, sculptures, etc., of these various stories. And when I first started to think about giving this talk, well, let me tell you the truth. I was going to give you a talk on deep meditation, and I looked at the paper that said it's going to rain Sunday morning and be miserable, and I says, well, I can't give an overly serious talk if the weather's going to be really bad. And so I tried to think of something that was more fun, especially for me. But I also thought, well, is this a proper topic for Zen students and Zen teachers, etc.? I haven't heard people give Jataka tales here as long, and I started here in 1976, etc. And when we usually think of Zen, we usually think of emptiness, a psychological practice, etc., that gets at the reality inside you, things like this. And that's an important part of Zen. But if we only concentrate on that part of Zen, we really kind of miss some of the real vigor, if you will, the real warmth, etc. Remember, Zen isn't just a teaching, but it's a whole culture. And it's a whole culture. It has more than just sitting. It has stories, it has people, it has temples, things like this. And the more I looked into the Jataka stories, to my surprise, it turns out that the master storyteller in North America who tells Jataka stories is a Zen person from the Rochester Zen Center called Raffi Martin. R-A-F-E, Raffi Martin. Many books, just two. One is One Hand Clapping, Zen Stories for All Ages. And that's more than just Jataka stories. But the other one specifically is called The Endless Path, Awakening Within the Buddhist Imagination, Jataka Tales, Zen Practice, and Daily Life. And his emphasis really is, besides just sitting, to carry these stories with you throughout the day and make them part of your imagination so you have some images to react to certain kinds of situations, etc. So it's a practice, and it's a way of being a bodhisattva, as we'll see. Remember, a bodhisattva is a person who makes a commitment to save all beings. And at the end of the talk this morning, we chant the four bodhisattva vows. You know, beings are numberless, vowing to free them. And this is what a bodhisattva does. And what the Jataka stories do is they show us, various ways to free all beings, if you will. It shows us failure. You don't always save all beings. Sometimes you mix up. And we learn that basically successes and failures are just part of our daily life, part of the Buddha way, part of the path, etc. Some people sometimes think, well, you know, I'm not ready yet. I've got to clean my act up before I can begin practicing. And that's kind of a misunderstanding, because failures and successes are our practice. There we go. Pema Chogren has a book with a wonderful title called Start Where You Are. And we all start where we are, if you will. So this is the bodhisattva way, if you will. And part of the purpose of the Jataka stories is to really kind of to ignite that feeling, which is sometimes called bodhicitta, etc. This idea, the aspiration, if you will, to save all beings as impossible as it sounds. Well, there are 547 traditional Jataka stories, but there are many more besides. And some of these stories, as far as we can tell, probably have their roots before the life of the Buddha. You know, they're part of ancient, deep Indian culture. Also, some of the stories were later developed in Mahayana centers, which is our branch of Buddhism. So it's not all early Buddhism or Theravadan Buddhism, etc., but you find these stories widespread throughout Buddhism, if you will. Each of these stories is based on one or more of the ten perfections, which we call the paramitas. And if you read the stories and you think of the ten perfections, etc., then you can see what they're getting at. In the ten perfections, I'll say them real fast so you can't memorize them here. Generosity, giving, which is the base perfection to all other perfections, etc. Virtue or morality, skillful means, wisdom, effort or vitality, patience, truthfulness, determination, loving kindness, and equanimity or imperturbability of mind in all conditions, etc. Sometimes in some branches of Buddhism, we find that strength, knowledge, and focused meditation sometimes is substituted in. Okay, and in many of the stories, we find kind of an interplay. On one hand, we find kindness, courage, humor, respect, etc., good positive character qualities versus selfishness, cruelty, cowardice, etc., and endless grumpiness, if you will. So there's this interplay between all of these kinds of things. Okay, just a little bit about the Jataka stories, and then I'm going to actually read some, or at least shortened versions of them. And these are stories of the Buddha's lives. In the story, the Buddha appears as a lizard, a deer, a monkey, you know, some kind of plant, etc., a poor person, a rich person, just about everything. And, of course, he had thousands and thousands of lives, and they talk about how he lived and had, new lives, through rebirth, etc., for many kalpas. And I remember the first time I heard the word kalpa, these great imagination things. A kalpa is how long it would take a bird who flies over the Himalayas twice a year on a migration route, and its wing just brushes the ground as it goes across, etc., to wear the Himalayas down flat. Okay, so I just like that image, etc. That's a kalpa. And so obviously, the Buddha had many lives. And of course, this is based upon the idea of rebirth, the idea that you are reborn, which is a deep Asian tradition. Each of these includes one or more the perfections. And in these stories, the Buddha is not always successful. As we'll see in one of the stories, he turns out to be a lustful hermit, etc., and on. So sometimes he's successful, sometimes he's not. Also, some of the stories can be quite disturbing, just like the Grimm's fairy tales. Now, most of us learn the Grimm fairy tales through the Walt Disney version. And you think of Cinderella, for example, and her two nasty stepsisters. Well, in the Disney version, of course, at the end, they all get therapy. They hug each other, and they live happily ever after. In the original Grimm's story, of course, the birds claw their eyes out as punishment, right? And so we find much the same thing. So again, not all of these stories are nursery tales. But most of them, at their root, have the idea of cause and effect, and of course, the karma, which is the very basis of our teachings, etc. That people have perform an action, and that there's a resulting effect. So what we find in these stories is the Buddhism going through this long evolution of spiritual development over kulpas and kulpas, etc. In all kinds of bodily forms. And I once thought, well, maybe, he looked better and better through time as his practice improved, etc. So I'd think, well, if you were in India, my wife was in India in February for 3 weeks, and saw a lot of poor people and beggars and things like this, and you'd think, wow, that person must have been a really bad character, etc., to be punished, though. But you learn through the Jataka stories that, well, maybe that's something you have to go through. You know what I mean? Maybe it's one of those obstacles, etc., that has a teaching. Another advantage of reading the Jataka stories is that they don't take place on the mat. But really, this is daily living. And so one lesson we gather from the stories is that our practice, our path, the Buddha way, is as we walk throughout our days, etc. And I think that's really an important teaching. Well, how do they work? And what they work by really inspiring our imagination. They give us images and stories, etc., that make us really a better person. If we read a story about bravery, we become braver. If we read a story about kindness, we become kinder. If we read a story about cause and effect, we become wiser. And as we all know, the world is made of stories. There's nothing to stand on, if you will. We are groundless outside our stories, if you will. Well, I'm going to read a few, and then quick interpretations. Typically, if you have a talk with a Jataka story, it's usually one story, and then the whole talk is about, the lesson, etc. But I'm just going to read a bunch of them in short versions just to give you a little feel for what they're like. And this is the first one is the story of a tigress, the famous tigress story. And it's a story about generosity. And I might mention that in different books you'll see there's long versions, short versions, badly written versions, really nicely written versions, etc. And this is a short, not too well-written version, but I found it on a whim. Okay, once the Buddha was born in a respectable family of scholars and mastered several commentaries on the sutras, soon he was disillusioned with the worldly life and renounced the same for the spiritual uplift. In the course of time, he proved his excellence in his pursuit and became the guru of several ascetics. One day, when wandering a forest along with his disciple Ajita, he saw from the top of a hill that a tigress was lurking to kill and eat her own cubs out of hunger. And in the longer version, the Buddha hears the stomach growl, and all kinds of things like this. Moved by compassion, he thought of sacrificing his own body to feed the tigress and save the cubs. So he sent away his disciple in search of some food for the tigress, lest he might prevent him from his sacrifice. No sooner than Akija left the site, the Buddha hung his robe up on a tree and jumped from the precipice in front of the tigress and offered his body. The noise of the fall caught the attention of the hungry tigress, who in no time scooped over him, tore him into pieces, and feasted upon them with her cubs. When Ajita returned and did not find his girl in the same place and saw the robe on the bushes, he looked around and was surprised to see that the tigress no longer looked hungry. Her cubs were also frolicking, but soon he was shocked to detect the blood-stained rags of his girl's dress scattered there. So he knew that his girl had offered the body to feed a hungry tigress and protected her young ones as an act of great charity. Now he also knew why he was sent away by his girl. He bowed his head out of reverence for his girl, who had exemplified the supreme sacrifice. And if you go to Horyuji Temple in Japan, or some of the one of the great temple caves in Dunhuang in China, you'll see pictures of this guy putting his robe up on a branch and then leaping into the air off the cliff to feed the tigress, etc. So I mentioned that selfless generosity is at the core of all the perfections, but how do we work with it? Now, certainly, I don't know about you, but I'm not ready to throw my body off the cliff to feed a hungry, starving tiger. So the question is, how do we work with it, etc.? How do we work with this story? What can it tell us, etc.? And basically, it's really meant to inspire our bodhisattva mind to awake. It sets models of really selflessness, etc., and that hopefully will awaken that bodhicitta in us, set us off on the bodhisattva path. Just thinking about it and feeling it with your heart, etc., are two different things. And once we feel that, etc., our practice begins. It begins there. And so we tell ourselves, beings are numberless, vowing to free them. And here's an ideal. And bit by bit, we start to feed ourselves to hungry tigers and lions, whether it's at work or in our family, whatever. Bit by bit, moment by moment, selfless giving emerges, etc. So it's a wonderful story to hold. And we don't have to leap off the cliff, of course, but this gives us an aspiration, if you will. And it awakens that real bodhisattva feeling within us. So here's another story of generosity of a different kind. This is generosity of spirit, and we can also say good manners, if you will. And this is more of a story for kids. This is called Mr. Monkey and Sir Crocodile, etc. And these are the kind of titles you have. Once upon a time, Mr. Monkey was living by himself near a riverbank. He was very strong, and he was a great jumper. In the middle of the river, there was a beautiful island covered with mango, jackfruit, and other fruit trees. There happened to be a rock sticking out of the water halfway between the bank and the island. Although it looked impossible, Mr. Monkey was used to jumping from the riverbank to the rock and from the rock to the island. He would eat fruits all day and then return home by the same route each evening. A high-class couple was living next to the same river, Sir Crocodile and Lady Crocodile. They were expecting their first brood of baby crocs. Because she was pregnant, Lady Crocodile sometimes wished for strange things to eat, so she made unusual demands on her faithful husband. Lady Crocodile had been amazed, just like the other animals, by the way Mr. Monkey jumped back and forth to the island. One day she developed a sudden craving to eat the heart of Mr. Monkey. She told Sir Crocodile about her desire. To please her, he promised to get Mr. Monkey's heart for her in time for dinner. Sir Crocodile went and laid himself down on the rock between the riverbank and the island. He waited for Mr. Monkey to return that evening, planning to catch him. As usual, Mr. Monkey spent the rest of the day on the island. When it was time to return to his home on the riverbank, he noticed that the rock seemed to have grown. It was higher above water than he remembered it. He investigated and saw that the river level was the same as in the morning, yet the rock was definitely higher. Immediately, he suspected the cunning Sir Crocodile. And you can imagine telling these stories to kids. To find out for sure, he called out in the direction of the rock. "Hi there, Mr. Rock, how are you?" He yelled this three times. Then he shouted, "You used to answer me when I spoke to you, but today you say nothing. What's wrong with you, Mr. Rock?" Sir Crocodile thought, "No doubt in other days this rock used to talk to the monkey. I can't wait any longer for this dumb rock to speak. I will just have to speak for the rock and trick the monkey." So he shouted, "I'm fine, Mr. Monkey. What do you want?" Mr. Monkey asked, "Who are you?" Without thinking, the crocodile replied, "I'm Sir Crocodile." "Why are you laying there?" asked the monkey. Sir Crocodile said, "I'm expecting to take your heart. Now, there's no escape for you, Mr. Monkey." The clever monkey thought, "Aha, he's right. There's no other way back to the riverbank, so I'll have to trick him." Then he yelled, "Sir Crocodile, my friend, it looks like you've got me, so I'll give you my heart. Open your mouth and take it when I come your way." When Sir Crocodile opened his mouth, he opened it so wide that his eyes were squeezed shut. When Mr. Monkey saw this, he immediately jumped onto the top of Sir Crocodile's head and then instantly to the riverbank. When Sir Crocodile realized he had been outsmarted, he admired Mr. Crocodile's victory. Like a good sport in a contest, he praised the winner. He said, "Mr. Monkey, my intention towards you was unwholesome. I wanted to kill you and take your heart just to please my wife, but you wanted only to save yourself and harm no one. I congratulate you." Then Sir Crocodile returned to Lady Crocodile. At first she was displeased with him, but when the little ones came, they forgot their troubles for a time. And so this is really generosity of spirit. And on the bottom it says, the moral is, a good loser is a true gentleman or gentlewoman. Practicing morals. Here's another story called The Prince Five Weapons and Sticky Hair. Sticky Hair, you probably can't see this, but there's great images of this beast with all kind of hair, sticky hair. Okay, and it's a long thing. I'm just going to read part of it and then summarize other parts, etc. Once upon a time, the enlightened being, the Buddha, was born as the son of the king and queen of Benares. On the day of his naming, 800 fortune tellers were invited to the palace. As presents, they were given whatever they desired to make them happy for the moment. Then they were asked to tell the fortune of the newborn prince. This was so they could find a good name for him. The fortune tellers were very clever. They told the king and queen whatever they wanted to hear. They said, "Your son will be skilled in five weapons. He will become famous as the greatest master of all five weapons throughout India." Now, based on this, the king and queen named their son Prince Five Weapons. This is the Buddha. When the prince turned 16, the king decided to send him to college. He said, "Go, my son, to the city of Takasila. There you will find a world-famous teacher. Learn all you can from him. Give him this money as payment." He gave him 1,000 gold coins and sent him on his way. The prince went to the world-famous teacher of Takasila. He studied very hard and became his best pupil. When the teacher had taught him all he knew, he gave the prince a special graduation award. He gave him five weapons. Then he sent him back to Benares. On his way home, he came to a forest which was haunted by a monster. The local people warned Prince Five Weapons, "Young man, don't go through the forest. There is a monster demon called Sticky Hair living there. He kills everyone he sees." And okay, I'm going to summarize some of this. Now, what he does is he has his five weapons, and he throws his spear at Sticky Hair, who, by the way, is taller than trees, just this huge monster, etc. And the spear sticks in the hair and doesn't hurt shoots 50 arrows at him, and then they all stick in Sticky Hair's hair. Nothing. He has a club, and he tries to smash him, and the club gets stuck in the air, and on, and he finally takes his right arm and gives him a great smashing blow, and his arm sticks to Sticky Hair. And he hits him this way, and his other arm sticks, and he kicks him one leg, and kicks him with the other leg, and finally, out of exasperation, he has nothing left. He butts him with his head. And, of course, there he is, stuck to Sticky Hair, etc. Sticky Hair is... even while sticking to the hairy monster in five places, hanging down from his coat, the prince had no fear. Sticky Hair thought, this is very strange indeed. He is more like a lion than a man. Even while in the grasp of a ferocious monster like me, he does not tremble with fear. In all the time I've been killing people in this forest, I've never met anyone as great as this prince. Why isn't he afraid of me? The prince continued speaking to Sticky Hair. There's one small detail, O monstrous one, I haven't told you about yet. In my belly is my secret weapon, a diamond weapon you cannot digest. It will cut into your intestines into pieces if you are foolish enough to swallow me. So if I die, you die. That's why I'm not afraid of you. In this way, the prince used his greatest inner strength in a way Sticky Hair could easily understand. He knew this greatest of all weapons, the one inside his mind, was the precious diamond gem of his own intelligence. Sticky Hair thought, no doubt this fearless man is telling the truth. Even if I eat as much as a pea-sized tidbit of such a hero, I won't be able to digest it. So I will let him go. Fearing his own death, he set Prince Five Weapons free. And then, of course, what's our hero do? Being a true bodhisattva, he teaches him the Dharma. And turns Sticky Hair into a protector of people who actually walk through the forest. And then in future years, once he becomes king, periodically he visits Sticky Hair to see how his practice is coming, etc. So this is a nice story as well. And basically, the paramita that's being exhibited is total effort or vigor, if you will. And so our prince displays total effort. This is the way of the bodhisattva, total effort. You don't try to save all beings one day and then take a week off. And if you look in the altar up here, you see the statue. This is Manjushri. Manjushri, by the way, is the prince of wisdom. And most of the things on the altar are there to kind of inspire us in our city. And if you don't recognize what the symbols are, you kind of miss, you know, a lot of what's going on in the Zendo, etc. And usually Manjushri has a sword. This person does not. And as you sit there, what he does is he, with all out effort, slashes your delusions. As you sit there, etc., and lead you to awakening, if you will. Just while we're looking at the altar real quickly, remember the flowers are impermanence. They're lovely today. They're gone tomorrow, right? And if you look at the candle, it's wisdom, if you will. If you look at the other altar there, you'll see a bowl of water. And that's emptiness, if you will. You can also look at all of these things if you're a devotional type of Buddhist as giving things to the Buddha. So the flowers, you're giving all the flowers in the world to the Buddha, etc. You're giving, if you burn incense, you're giving the Buddha all the perfume, and on and on and on. So there's a lot of symbolism there, if you will. No fear. You don't stop. So this is, now I told this story because it's quite different than the tiger story. In the tiger story, of course, I remember how the Buddha gave his body for food. In this story, our prince is all out effort, etc., to conquer Sticky Bear, the momentarily evil one, if you will. And the message is, of course, no one way. No one way. And it reminds me of a title of one of Suzuki Roshi's book called Not Always So. Not Always So. If you will. So, the idea is, as a bodhisattva, you use skillful means. And sometimes your effort can be quite vigorous, as our prince does, smash, etc. Other times it's very gentle and it's very quiet, etc. Though it's ceaseless effort, if you will. And then the last thing I wanted to bring your attention to is, though Sticky Hair is his enemy, at least initially, etc., that in the end, like a true bodhisattva, he tries to save all beings, etc., and turns Sticky Hair around. Well, here's another a little story about effort, or in this case, lack of effort, and what happens. And in this particular story, the Buddha is a lazy student. Okay. And so once upon a time, there was a world-famous teacher and holy man in the city of Takasila. Now, the story is called The Greenwood Gatherer. And in parenthesis, it says laziness, etc. Now, this famous teacher had 500 students training under him. One day, these 500 young men went into the forest to gather firewood. One of them came upon a tree with no leaves. He thought, how lucky I am. This tree must be dead and dry, perfect for firewood. So what's the hurry? I'll take a nap while the others are busy searching in the woods. You can see the plot thickens, right? Yeah. When it's time to return, it'll be easy to climb this tree and break off branches for firewood. So what's the hurry? He spread his jacket on the ground, lay down on it, and fell fast asleep, snoring loudly. After a while, all the other students began carrying their bundles of firewood back to Takasila. On their way, they passed the snoring sleeper. They kicked him. They kicked him to wake him up and said, wake up. It's time to return to our teacher. The lazy student woke up suddenly and rubbed his eyes. Still not fully awake, he climbed up the tree. He began breaking off branches and discovered that they were actually still green, not dry at all. While he was breaking one of them, it snapped back and poked him in the eye. From then on, he had to hold his eye with one hand while he finished gathering this bundle of green wood. Then he carried it back to Takasila, running to catch up. He was the last one back and threw his bundle on top of the rest. Meanwhile, an invitation arrived for a religious ceremony. It was to be held the next day at a remote village. The holy man told his 500 pupils, "This will be good training for you. You will have to eat an early breakfast tomorrow morning, then go to the village for the religious service. When you return, bring back my share of the offerings as well as your own." The students awoke early the next morning. They awakened the college cook and asked her to prepare their breakfast porridge. She went out in the dark to the woodpile. She picked up the top bundle of the lazy man's green wood. She brought it inside and tried to start her cooking fire. But even though she blew and blew on it, she couldn't get the fire going. The wood was too green and damp. When the sun came up, there was still no fire for cooking breakfast. The student said, "It's getting to be too late to go to the village," so off they went to their teacher. The teacher asked them, "Why are you still here? Why haven't you left yet?" They told him, "A lazy good-for-nothing slept while we all," and that's our Buddha, "slept while we all worked. He climbed a tree and poked himself in the eye. He gathered only green wood and threw it on top of the woodpile. This was picked up by the college cook. Because it was green and damp, she couldn't get the breakfast fire started. And now it's too late to go to the village." The world-famous teacher said, "A fool who is lazy causes trouble for everyone. When what should be done early is put off until later, it is soon regretted." And the moral is, of course, don't put off until tomorrow what you can do today, etc. So this is the Buddha as a lazy student. Okay, one last kind of longer story, and this one's called Gentle Heart. And it has to do with the perfection of morality. Long ago, when Brahmadatta reigned in Benares, the Buddha was born into a Brahmin family in the Kasi country. There are Jatakas where he's born into poverty, but here he's pretty high class, though not necessarily noble. His youth and childhood were happy, and yet when he was grown and had finished his education, he saw little profit in the ways of the world and chose instead the hermit's path. Retiring to the Himalayas, he built a hut and devoted himself to meditation. Making a strong effort, he attained to the selfless knowledge of prajna and entered the awakened life of an arhat. There he lived high up on the peaks, absorbed in bliss. One day he ran out of salt, vinegar, and other staple items. Piling his tangled hair up in a knot on his head, he straightened his bark clothes, put an antelope skin over his shoulder, and thus properly attired, headed down the mountain to Benares to gather alms. As he walked along the streets receiving his alms in the traditional way of a religious beggar, he came to the palace of the king. The king, glancing from his window, saw the youthful ascetic standing there, bowl in hand, and was struck by the man's dignified, serene bearing. He invited the ascetic into the palace, offered him a golden couch to sit on, and delicacies to eat, then asked for teaching. The ascetic gave them freely and well, exhorting the king to be charitable, to think of the welfare of others, and to never cease seeking wisdom. The king was impressed and wanted his whole family and the palace nobles to also benefit from such inspired words. So he requested that the hermit remain. I'll have a hut built in my gardens where you can continue your meditation uninterrupted, he said. All I ask is that you teach me, my family, and the court. I hope you will accept this sincere request. The hermit did accept and was happy to guide the king and nobles along the path of generosity, compassion, and wisdom. The king benefited and so did the people. And there the ascetic lived for 16 years, maintaining his own practice and coming regularly to the palace to receive meals and offer teachings. Eventually the king had to go off to settle a border dispute. He told his queen, Gentleheart, that while he was gone, she should make sure that their teacher continued to receive his meals, and he added, request him to continue teaching as well. Then the king left. While the hermit's meal was being prepared in the kitchen below, the queen took her bath. After the bath, she put on her robe, and as the hermit was late in arriving, she lay down on her couch and closed her eyes to rest, trusting she'd be notified when he arrived. The ascetic rose from his meditation, and seeing that the hour was late, instead of walking to the palace as he usually did, this time he rose up into the air and flew swiftly there, entering the palace unannounced through a window on the second floor. And of course, there's all kinds of superpowers you read about. The queen, it's not mine. The queen lay half asleep on her couch. Hearing the rustling of the ascetic's bark clothing, she rose. As she did, her robe fell open, and the hermit saw the queen's naked beauty fully exposed. He gazed and could not turn his mind or eyes away. A shiver ran through him. For all of insight, wisdom, and charity, he was not prepared, and he felt like a tree cut by the axe. Realization left him, and from that moment on, all he knew was desire, flaming and overwhelming. And there are a couple pages here. It is Mother's Day. he actually, you know, becomes ill from his lust, etc., and retires to his hut. The king comes back and says, where's the hermit? He's ill in his hut. The king goes to see him, and he admits to the king that he's fallen deeply, passionately in love with Gentleheart. And so being a good king, he says, she can be yours. But the king and the queen, very skillful and clever people, get together and concoct a plan. Now, that is skillful means, etc. Our hermit says, well, come, my beloved, to my hut. And the queen says, well, it's too small. It's hardly big enough for one person. And so then the king says, well, here's this little cottage over here. It's in great disrepair. You have to fix it up. And so in all this ardor and lust, smoke coming out of the ears, you know, all the things that we remember from us as youngsters or whatever. He fixes it up and he says, well, come to my hut. And she goes and she says, but there's no door. And so he just runs like mad and finally puts a door on. And you can see page after page, etc. And he finally gets the door on, and then he hurried to retrieve the beautiful Gentleheart, his Gentleheart. Shyly, he led her to their home. She smiled as she looked over the exterior. Good walls, roof, animal pen, door. She stepped inside. It's lovely, she said, looking around. Truly perfect. You've done a great job. Now come with me. Closing the door, she took the ascetic by the hand and led him to the bed. So they sat down facing each other. She put her hands on his broad shoulders and could feel his heart pounding wildly. She reached up, took hold of his beard, drew his face close to hers, looked him in the eyes and said with surprising force, you are a good man, and you are a holy man, a sage. Have you forgotten yourself? And just like that, in a flash, he saw it all. How he had lost his awareness and gotten lost in a little heavenly dream. Saw how his mind had been overcome, his practice long since flown away. He was startled and ashamed, shocked, really, to see how desire had so quickly inflamed and then dominated his mind. And he saw, too, how unprepared and raw he still was, how unready yet to give guidance to others, how immature still in his actual embodiment of the way. And then he remembered his own deep vows, and with that he regained his underlying determination to awaken fully and be of help to all beings who face loss and illness, aging and death, without a guide, a bridge, a raft. He saw, too, that he stood poised on the edge of a knife, and that so far, at least, no real harm had been done. Gentle Heart is not mine, he thought. She is the king's wife, the queen, and has been both wise and very kind, and so has the king. To go further now, I would begin the betrayal. That is where immorality would start. With that, he bowed to the beautiful queen, then walked out of the now lovely cottage. With awareness regained and powers restored, he rose up into the air and flew back to the Himalayas. Lapses like that won't do, he admonished himself as he flew through the sky. Flying has its uses, but walking on the ground is not as easy as it looks from up here. It might be wiser in the future to master fewer special powers and more ordinary ones. I was hasty. Those people know things I don't. Back to work.
Okay.
So this is the story of the perfection of morality, etc. And it's an important Chautauqua story today. As we all know, in the 80s and 90s, etc., almost every Zen center throughout North America had a sexual scandal of some kind, including this one, if you will. So it's an important story. Remember, hold in our imagination. Emptiness, or being emptiness, doesn't mean anything goes, right? We all need some kind of an ethical foundation. And even though we fall down and stand up and fall down and stand up, we have that ethical foundation. And in our case, it's the precepts, etc. And if you commit yourself to Buddhism, etc., you sow a little rakasu, it's called, etc., etc. You take the precepts and you make those vows, if you will. So in this story, the Buddha fails, etc. But failure may be crucial for our practice. Even a high degree of insight is no guarantee. And it's interesting in this story, on one hand, we see a person with highly developed non-dual awareness, emptiness, if you will. This is a hermit. On the other hand, we find the very skillful king and queen who don't have non-dual awareness, but they certainly know how to use skillful means, right? Because from the very beginning, they have a way really to awaken it once again, the hermit. So in this case, imagination, etc. Remember, the purpose of the Chautauqua stories, etc., is to give us images, etc., and to give us guidance, etc. This story is a powerful one. And what we see here is the process. In our practice, we slip, we recognize the slip, we grow. And we slip, we recognize the process, we grow. And again, you slip, you recognize the process, and we go. Now, so there's a real process here. In my view, just sitting by itself is essential, but not sufficient by itself, etc. That we do need our stories, etc., to walk along the path to save all beings. Now, I might mention that, of course, sex isn't bad, as we all know, etc., but the hermit, had taken vows, and so in this case he's violating his vows. Rafi Martin, in one of his books, mentioned he gave one of these this particular story, etc., to a Zen center where Philip Kaplow Roshi was, and he was the author of the Three Pillars of Zen, etc. And one student said, Roshi, when's the last time you lusted? And, of course, the experienced students were horrified, because the Roshi was known for, he was kind of a crusty guy, etc., and had, didn't hesitate to really tell somebody off, etc. But the Roshi thought for a minute and said, 20 minutes ago, he said, I was coming up in the elevator, and there's a lovely young lady, etc., and I could feel this kind of arising, etc. And so it's not just the, when you become empty or whatever, it's not like your emotions go away, etc., but you recognize them. And I've told this story before, but I like it. This is a Jack Kornfield story. He studied with Ajahn Chah, who was a Thai forest monk. In their particular practice, what they do is they learn basic emotions so that when they arise, you're aware of them. You know, you practice them, you recognize them, etc. You learn how to handle them, etc. Some groups have 52. The others have over 100 of different kinds of emotions that they learn to recognize. And so one day Ajahn Chah says, now I want all of you students to go to this distant village, etc., and do this task. And, of course, it was hot and steamy, and it was a minor task. One person could have done it. It was far away, etc. Everybody was mad. They all came back, and they were just sitting there fuming. Ajahn Chah looks at them all and laughs. And I'm going to use this word, and says, now that's what being pissed off feels like. Okay. And of course, we could say another word, that, you know, being irritated, etc. But it really, it was very clever, you know, very clever teaching, etc. Okay. I might mention, too, that desire doesn't have to just be a sexual desire. It could be a desire for a new car, a new job, a bigger house, etc. So it's not that these feelings don't come up, but it's your reactive emotions and how you actually react to them. Perhaps from this story, like the other ones, we can say we all get caught. We all fall down. But we want to see all of these as opportunities to grow. Well, I have time. I do not have time. I was going to talk about, give a little reading of The Dancing Peacock about pride, but we'll forget that. Let me end quickly by saying that we have this image, etc., that somehow people were more perfect than us in the past, in that we just don't live up to the standards of people that once held. And all of that makes me think of some stories from John McCrae's book, Seen Through Zen, which is a delightful kind of postmodern Buddhist book, etc. He starts by having McCrae's, he must have been a real card, McCrae's rules of studying Buddhism, in specifically Chinese Buddhism. And the first rule is it's all false, therefore it's more important, etc. And he's making the point that, well, of course people didn't live the way we read about, etc. But what's really important is that they thought that these ideals, these aspirations, etc., were something that we should aim for. So again, it's all false, but it's more important. The second one, and perhaps even a more important one, is a romanticization leads to cynicism. And I think that's a very important one. Is that if we romanticize the past, we see people other than they are, etc. And then we look around us and look at our leaders, etc. And then the doubt, the cynicism kind of sneaks in. And so I think when we look at these stories, etc., we just want to see people as they are, see ourselves as we are. And it's almost 10:02. So anyway, thank you very much. Any stories? Don't be shy. Well, I can tell you what the Dancing Peacock, in a few words, real quickly. The great king of the birds, the golden swan, promised his daughter, I'll give you one wish if you want. He says, when I'm ready, I want to pick my own person to marry. When it's time, he gathers all the big birds in the Himalayas together, all kinds of birds, etc. And she looks him over, and here's this great peacock, you know, just gorgeous peacock. And she says, him. I want him. And the peacock just bursts, you know, he gets his feathers up here, he does all kinds of things and acts like a fool, right? And that's pride. And the king finally says, my daughter's not going to marry an ignorant fool like that. And he loses the princess. Well, thank you very much.